On this episode of ID the Future, listen to a lecture given by David Snoke at a conference sponsored by the Christian Scientific Society, hosted at Discovery Institute in November 2015. Dr. Snoke, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Pittsburgh, answers the question, is information a physical entity? And discusses the nature of information processing systems.
We have David Snoke. He's going to be talking about statistical mechanics and information. This is going to be our last talk.
So what I want to do actually is something that's a little bit narrower in focus, not really making an ID argument at all, but really just talking about the physicality of information and what it implies, and there'll be some things along the way that connect to intelligent design and the arguments that are made. But in general, there, you know, we've seen a lot of discussion about, you know, what is information and so on, and I sort of want to just report to you what goes on in the physics world. In general, the sort of physical nature of information is just common language in the physics world. So this, you know, people who we've heard mention who say, well, information is not a real thing, or it's only between humans or something like that. That's not the way physicists typically talk. So I really want to just connect you to some of the work that's been done over several decades of work in thermodynamics. And I realize that thermodynamics is probably not the most exciting course that you ever took, if you ever took those. It's funny because it tends to be taught in a sort of a tedious way, but actually it's had some of the most hot controversies, and Boltzmann, one of the founders of the field, committed suicide because his beliefs were not accepted. And so it has to do with enormous things that relate to us all, such as why is there even time? Why do we have an experience of time? Why do we have an experience of memory? And so on. So let me start with this question. Is information a physical thing? And that kind of thing importantly gets to something that in physics we call extensive quantities. A lot of times people have a great difficulty with information, thinking about, like, is it a thing I can hold in my hand, like an apple or a rock? Well, no, then it must not be a physical thing. It must be in the spirit world. Well, that's not quite the way that we work in physics. In general, we have these concepts of extensive quantities that can only be defined for a large ensemble. And they, in some sense, have no meaning for small ensembles. We really define them only for a large-scale thing. So heat is one. I'll come back to that. Entropy is another. Free energy. These are all things that are defined for a whole system. So in some sense, you could say that they're relational, that they're defined only for the system, the collective property of the whole. And so it's really a description of the relationship of the parts, which can certainly be a real physical thing. Another thing about them is that they're proportional to the size of the system. So you can have more or less of it. So you can have more heat or less heat. You can flow heat from here to there, and so on and so forth. And the same is true of entropy and free energy, and so on and so forth. So one that you're probably familiar with is heat. Heat is mathematically defined this way. This is for a gas. It's the sum of the motions of the particles relative to the center of mass. Notice the relational nature of it. It's related to what all the other particles are doing. But the thing is, even though we might define it mathematically this way, heat is a real thing, right? You have heat sensors in your fingers. You can detect heat. You know that it's real. And so even though we might say it's only a property of a large number of particles, it's still very much real and tangible. It's something that you can feel literally with your fingers. Now, entropy in physics is thought of just the same way. Entropy, you can define mathematically as the log of the total number of equivalent states. So that is going to be proportional to the size of the system, because the bigger the system, the more states you have in general. Equivalent is defined only macroscopically for the whole system. And so you might say, for a given set of particles, I want them all at the same pressure, the system to have a given pressure and a given density. How many ways are there to have the particles in the box to have that same pressure and density and temperature and so on? And so there could be many ways to do that. Now, just as a little side note, it's actually tricky to count the number of states as a number in a system with continuous variables like position and momentum, but there's actually a standard trick to do that, which goes way back to the 1800s, which is to sort of arbitrarily imagine space divided into discrete little cells and then simply label, okay, in that little cell I've got one particle, in that cell I've got one particle, and so on. So it's a trick. Now, when we went to quantum mechanics, turned out that this became actually much more accurate than we thought, and there's actually a natural way to define states in quantum mechanics. But it turns out that all of the properties that we care about don't actually depend very much on the details of how we quantize things. And so we can define these possible states in general. It's a trick that we're able to do. So, for instance, in thermodynamics, you have equations like this, where you have the free energy is equal to the internal energy minus the temperature times the entropy. And so we're saying now, we started out defining entropy simply mathematically, it's counting up the number of equivalent states, but now we're saying we can go back and forth between it and energy. So we can transfer, just like E equals mc squared equates, you know, energy and mass and so on, here we've got fungibility between energy and entropy. We're able to flow one between the other. So if you think of energy as real, there's no reason to think of entropy as not real. Entropy is a quantity. I can have a bucket and I can pour entropy from one place to another. It may seem strange, but it's possible. Now, entropy is different from other ones in that it's not conserved. So that total energy has to be conserved, of course. That's the first law of thermodynamics. But the second law says that entropy can spontaneously increase. Now, we have to be careful here. You can locally decrease entropy if you increase entropy somewhere else, and the place where you increased it was more than what you decreased. So that's always possible. So in general, though, entropy is not conserved. It can get larger. And so a lot of people have difficulty visualizing what is entropy. Entropy can be thought of as disorder. It's a measure of the disorder in the system. And so we have, in common language, the second law of thermodynamics, disorder always increases. And so you could say your house gets spontaneously dirty. You don't need to work to get it dirty, but you need to work to get it clean, right? And so things do not spontaneously get more ordered. The reason why, so mathematically it's defined as the number of equivalent states, the reason why we associate with that with disorder is because in general things that are disorderly can be arranged and they remain disorderly, right? So if I have a junk pile, I could rearrange the junk pile and I could rearrange it in many ways, it would still be a junk pile, right? Whereas if I took your brain and rearranged it in many ways, it would no longer be a working brain, right? So things that are in a large number of equivalent states are assumed to be very disorderly. So actually, I'm not going to talk about this at all, but you could give a whole talk on the arrow of time. This fact that we have the second law implies that we have an experience of time going forward. So if I play a movie in which I drop an egg on the carpet and it breaks, and then I showed you that movie, you could tell which way was the arrow of time of that movie, because eggs don't spontaneously gather together and jump off of the carpet. Right? And so you know which way time is going. Okay, so now let's talk about information. A lot of stuff has been done on information and entropy connections going way back to the early 20th century. There's a natural connection of entropy and information. So we've heard about Shannon information before, okay? Shannon information can be defined as the log of the number of possible states that the existing state was chosen from. So that looks a lot like our definition of entropy, right? So our entropy definition was the log of the number of equivalent states, right? Here we've got a log of a number of possible states. So there's a similarity, but they're not identical. They're not the same thing. And it's not adequate to simply say that information is the negative of entropy. We have to do a little more work. So here's an example of this, and we've heard about bits, of course. So if I have a memory bank with 8 bits, it has 256 possible states. Now, if there's nothing demanding them to be in one state or the other, then they're all equivalent. We don't care which state it's in, okay? And so we would say there's 256 possibilities. If I take the log base 2, then I would get the number 8, all right? And that would be my Shannon information. It has 8 bits of information. Now, here's a point that I want to stress. In order for something to be a good information-holding system, it has to have what's called contingency, which is to say that no force determines one state over another. Okay. If it did, all right, then we would say basically, I know what it's going to do. It's going to go into the fourth state, right? It's going to go into this one. The whole point of having possible states is to say, you know, if there's only one possible state, then there's no information value in that, right? Okay. But if I say this is one of 256 possibilities, as Casey was saying, information you can view as a reduction of possibilities. You're saying that you started with 256 possibilities, and now we're picking just one of them. And so it would be valid to say I chose it from those if it was possible to actually have all of them. If physics demanded it to be just one of them, then there would be no information quantity. You say, I just know what's going to happen. There's no way around it. So my first point here is information, like entropy, is a physical thing. It's an extensive property. So I'll say this at this point, in that it's defined very similarly, right? It's defined as a counting thing, but we'll come back to differences and similarities between information and entropy. Now, as I said, good information systems look like this, right? You've got a lot of equivalent positions, right? So you've got all kinds of places to store bits in this. This is a nanoscale, what's inside of your memory chips and your computers. This is DNA, has a lot of equivalent things. And one of the points is that DNA makes a good information store because if I was to change this to a different codon here, it wouldn't be energetically any more costly. And so I can have any number of codes in here represented without energy cost between them. And the same way here, you know, if I fire off this guy or fire off that guy into a one bit, it's not costing me any more energy. And so that means that it's basically has many, many possibilities allowed to it, or what's called contingency. So here's one point I think that really affects the ID debate and some of the stuff we talked about earlier this morning. Essentially, by definition, good information carrying systems are intrinsically history erasing systems. Because, well, let me expand out on this, okay? Deterministic processes that favor one state over another remove contingency. We're saying that deterministic processes say only this outcome is possible, right? And the other ones are not. And so it forces it, and we use that term force as a deterministic process that forces things into a certain state, okay? Now, this is where I think a lot of the problem in talking to even very friendly theistic evolutionists comes up, is that our standard model of a scientific explanation involves a history. So essentially, for several hundred years in physics, when we say, what's the explanation for X? The answer is always, the series of physical forces that caused that was the following. Right? And so a lot of times when I'm talking to scientists who are friendly theistic evolutionists, and you say something like, well, the explanation for this is it's got intelligent design, they say, what's the history? When did the design get inserted? You know, so essentially, what they're hearing is a non-explanation. They're hearing that I said nothing, because their paradigm is that an explanation, by definition, is a history. Okay, that you're telling me what happened first, then what happened second, then what happened third, and what was the process that led to this. And that's the only thing that counts as an explanation in a lot of our thinking. Intrinsically, information systems do not allow such a possibility, because information systems are contingent. They allow many possibilities. And so you can't deduce. So for example, I have this example here. If you are given a book and you read the book, okay, you will not be able to deduce what order the chapters are written in. You might assume the author wrote them in order, but they might not have. They might have started out with a really good idea for chapter 5 and then gone back and said, I need to write chapter 1 to introduce this. And I write papers like this all the time. I write the conclusion first, then I go back and write other parts and so on. Or I'll describe the figures, I'll generate the figures, I'll go back and so on. There is no way to deduce from a set of information how it was generated, almost by definition, because the information carrying medium erases all history because it's non-deterministic, because it allows for contingency. So the very fact that it allows many states as possibilities means that it doesn't carry a history with it of how that was generated. Of course, unless you write it in and say, I wrote chapter one first, or something like that. But in general, it's not something you get just from the physical aspects of the novel itself.
Or Star Wars,
yeah. Which episode was really episode number one, right?
Yeah. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Snoke. This has been ID the Future. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.